Hi there. We are delighted to be involved in this week's edition of Job Shadowing HE. I'm Vivi. I'm the founder of Black Bullion, and we are the home of student money. Black Bullion helps universities and colleges to help their students to learn everything that they need to know about money and develop their financial confidence and skills. We work with corporates and we work with universities to provide additional funding for students through our scholarship hub, and our brand new app will help students to manage their money as best as they possibly can. We're delighted to be involved and look forward to your thoughts. Bye.
Welcome to Job Shadowing HE, the podcast that delves into the roles of people working in higher education. Each episode hears from guests about what it's like to do their role, the career path that led to it, and tips on how to get in and get on in these jobs. My guest in this episode is Rachel Reeds, Senior Admissions Manager at Anglia Ruskin University. Rachel has worked in higher education for around 13 years and undertook a series of roles before landing in the admissions profession. In this episode, Rachel talks about her role as well as her approach to authentic leadership and how her style enables and empowers her team. She also shares with us the benefits of undertaking the postgraduate certificate HE Administration Leadership and Management and gives some insight into the book that she has created to support HE professionals thrive and survive in their roles. So, Rachel, welcome to Job Shadowing HE. Thank you for being my guest today. Let's start off with an overview of your role. You're Senior Admissions Manager, Faculty Operations at Anglia Ruskin University. Can you tell us some more about your main responsibilities, size of your team, who you report to, and how all this fits together?
Overall, I'm responsible for ensuring a smooth and efficient admissions process that meets the university's recruitment goals for home admissions. I lead a team of around 30 admissions managers and officers who work on the operational side of admissions, working with applicants, faculties and departments across the university, supporting taught undergraduate, taught postgraduate, CPD and degree apprenticeships. I report into the head of admissions and work closely with another senior admissions manager who leads the customer service and safeguarding functions within our team. Some universities have admissions centralized completely, but we have a separate international admissions team, and we are based within our corporate marketing directorate along with recruitment and marketing. Personally, as the senior admissions manager, I spend my time supporting my team in delivering the operational outcomes and working on implementing an informing strategy, process improvement, lots of process improvement, training, analysis, collaborating with faculties and other departments, and ensuring that we're compliant with our professional body and regulatory bodies.
And from what I've read, you started your career actually outside of HE in local council work before moving into higher education in 2011. And since then, you've taken a series of different roles. What is it that attracted you into higher education? And while you've been in the sector, have there been any sort of opportunities or risks you've taken along the way to get to where you are now?
When I graduated university, all I knew was that I wanted to work in the public sector in a role that served the community in some form or another. So I started working in local government. And while that was very rewarding initially, I wanted to find a role in the public sector that enabled me to step away from the politics of local government. And so that's what drew me to higher education. For me, I've worked across the student journey as I've worked in higher education. I didn't start in admissions. My first role was in quality assurance. And there were probably two really key pivotal points in my career that shifted my focus as I went through. Firstly, I was working in the quality assurance role and felt that I was missing something in my training and development background that meant, because I'd come in at the level I had, I didn't have a technical understanding of the student administrative journey that the course administrators that I was working with on a day-to-day basis and the faculty administrators had. And it made my job so much harder because I didn't have that technical process background. And so my choice at that point was to step down a grade in HE speak into a course administration role to build that technical knowledge and to work more closely with the students and that we as an institution were trying to serve, because I was very detached from them working in that quality assurance role. A lot of people told me it was a crazy thing to do. Why would you go backwards? Although, of course, no decision that we make is going backwards. We're always building on our learning. And I had a wonderful 2 years working in a really motivated, energized team. I found a very nerdy love of student record systems I never knew I'd had, would have. And it was a fantastic grounding in that student journey. Then after a while, when I got that itch to find a new challenge and I felt ready to step up and move into a supervisory post, that led me to my work in the research graduate school with oversight of research degree admissions, which was my first introduction to admissions and my first line management responsibility.
So admissions made its first appearance in your career journey at that stage. How did you then build upon that to fully immerse yourself in the admissions profession?
My second pivotal career turning point was during that time. I was invited to work on a project for the summer that involved working with a manager from finance and the admissions manager for tort provision in enrolling a cohort from a new partner. I had the right experience with my background in course administration and was really keen to make the most of that opportunity, even though I wasn't quite sure where it might take me. I learned a huge amount from the admissions manager on that project and built a really strong professional relationship with them. So when a management role came up in home admissions, I was keen to go for it and really successful in securing it, despite my lack of substantive admissions background, because I demonstrated my knowledge and experience from across the student journey and what I did know about admissions through that project.
And admissions is the linchpin between an applicant thinking about coming to an institution through to starting their studies. So I'm interested to know a bit more. What is it about the admissions function and the admissions profession that's made it your focus for that most recent part of your career?
For me, admissions draws together everything I particularly enjoy. It gives me the opportunity to really positively influence people's opportunities at the start of their journey in higher education, to engage with increasing access and widening participation activities, and to set people off on their journey through their studies and their journey through the university's administration systems. So in admissions, I feel like I can have the greatest impact on challenging assumptions and creating opportunity for others. We, as admissions officers, guide and support academic colleagues and applicants alike through really complicated processes and regulations. And I love a challenge. And every applicant has a unique set of circumstances. So I really enjoy pushing the rules to their limit and challenging our entrenched assumptions to facilitate opportunities for our applicants that they might not have had if we had just taken that surface level perspective. The sector since 2022 has adopted a Fair Admissions Code of Practice, which I'm very committed to. It's something that universities and other higher education institutions have signed up to, which demonstrates their commitment to admissions processes that are transparent, focused on potential ability to succeed, fair, consistent, inclusive, and professional. And that's become the cornerstone of my admissions practice and the professional practice that I look to see my team demonstrate.
So you mentioned earlier that you lead a team of around 30 people. And when I was reading up on you and thinking just about what you've just said just now, I noticed that authentic leadership is really important to you. Bringing your whole self to work can require courage as well as still retaining the right boundaries. What does your authenticity look like, and how does it enable you in your role and also in supporting your team?
Managing and navigating people, resources, services, your own manager, internal politics, external politics, etc., requires leadership skills. And the ultimate goal as a manager, as a leader, is to deliver on your department's short and long-term objectives. And to do all of that, you have to rely on other people. So for me, I believe that developing your own philosophy of leadership is the best way to do people management. And my approach is focused on authenticity, as you've touched on. For me, authenticity is about relational transparency, respect, advocacy, inclusion, and empowerment. They bring together sort of the themes of my approach to authentic leadership. And it's an active choice. It's not easy. A key example for me about bringing my whole self to work and being authentic and true is my anxiety, which I've suffered with for a long time. And it's something that is difficult to bring into your practice, because we try and leave all the difficult things at the door, the stuff that makes us less than infallible. We feel very pressured as leaders to be unflappable, navigate challenges super calmly, and hide any vulnerability. But I think that reinforces some of the boundaries between us and them, between management and between the operational staff on the ground, as it were. And it's a recipe for burnout, because you're not bringing your full self. You're leaving part of a really important and very influential part of yourself at the door. So I try to embrace it and see it as a strength and something that I can utilize to build stronger relationships with my team and to build a more resilient team.
Sharing your anxiety with the team is a brave thing to do, and showing that vulnerability. And thank you for sharing that too on the podcast. How does your openness with the team play out in practice, and how does it support them?
An example of this for me is when I shared some of my coping mechanisms with an anxious team member. They were so relieved, because I offered practical strategies rather than reassurance or dismissing their worries as excessive. I just went in with the practicalities, and they were able to navigate what they needed to get their work done and move forward rather than dwelling on that concern. So for me, I see authenticity as a strength, not a weakness, and definitely not a lazy approach to management. It does take some concerted effort to be true to yourself, and then that allows me to really expect that of my team to take that to our applicants as well, and give every one of those applicants that same respect and opportunity and empathic approach.
And the setting that you've outlined there is very, as you said, open, transparent and supportive. And you've just mentioned about how you like to, I guess, translate those principles into the work that you and your team does with applicants. Can you say a bit more about how that works in practice?
It very much aligns with our code of practice and our professional ethics that we follow, and really supports us when we're having to do some of the harder sides of interacting with applicants. We can't always give applicants the answers they want from us. We can't always say yes. And sometimes that's due to regulations, funding, or professional bodies. Other times it's policy or logistics and timing. What we always do is clearly explain why we've made a decision and give the applicant options. Most no's in higher education admissions are actually not now, rather than not ever. And there are so many things that an applicant can do to get onto their preferred path in the future. And that's where my commitment to fair and inclusive admissions comes to the fore, because I see that as extending into the advice and guidance space. And I want any applicant we can't offer a place to on their preferred course to know how they can achieve their goal. And that hopefully will bring them back to us at a future stage. And even if we can't offer what they want, they should conclude their interaction with us knowing that what they need to do to get where they want, what their options are now, and feeling that it was a positive discussion, even if it didn't lead them to their initial first choice.
And as a centralised admissions team, you'll have a certain amount of autonomy in the decisions about accepting or rejecting applicants, or as you say, giving them some advice about what to do next. And those decisions are obviously within an agreed framework. But I guess there'll also be cases which are less clear cut, and you're going to be working more closely with academic staff to make a final decision. Reflecting back on those leadership principles that you've just been talking about there and the ethos of your team, how does that play out in the working relationships with academic colleagues?
It's very central tenet in admissions. One of the biggest challenges is managing applicant expectations alongside faculty expectations, which can be in opposition at times. And one of the key challenges is communication, because academics and professional services staff sometimes talk different languages. Admissions very much talk in process terms, and academics will talk more in recruitment and academic terms. So there can be some miscommunications at times. So I really try to focus on translating everything that we're trying to do or everything we're trying to communicate into plain English and show our workings out. You have to sort of demonstrate that competence. Academic colleagues aren't necessarily just going to trust you straight away and say, of course, these admissions people must know what they're doing. So it can be helpful at times to lay that out. And that also links into making recommendations to change or to do something new. I would always draw on evidence. So look at trends, sector developments, or academic research that has shown that certain choices around interview models, for example, has had benefits for recruitment.
And how do you extend that approach across your team and enable them to work in a similar and confident way?
I want the admissions officers on the ground to have the same level of respect from academic colleagues and faculty, and the same level of confidence in the knowledge that they're bringing to the table as they would have of me or of the head of admissions. And that's something that takes time and to build that reputation. But the confidence that the team demonstrate therefore gives academics greater confidence when they're dealing with them, because they're speaking much more confidently and assertively about what they believe to be true and are able to articulate what regulation that would be compliant or non-compliant with. And it links into evidence-based decision-making as well. So whenever we make a decision, whether that be something we need to communicate to an applicant or an academic, the same principles apply, giving that explanation and making sure we're demonstrating that we've explored all possible avenues and laying out what options somebody has, rather than just saying no. Never say no. Say, well, these are all the challenges that what you'd like to do might create. Are you sure you want to go ahead with it? And see how we go from there. And I bring it back to the code of practice as well. Sometimes when things are getting tricky, it's always about the applicant, and they're who we need to keep at the center of everything. And just because we can do something, if it's to the letter of the regulations, the thing that springs to mind for me is accreditation of prior learning in particular. Just because we've got some flexibility doesn't mean that's in the applicant's best interest. And we should balance wanting to award previous credit against the value of a really strong cohort identity and wanting applicants to start their studies at the beginning of an academic year, so they get that strong cohort community right from the off, rather than jumping around between cohorts.
Let's focus in on professional development. You've recently completed the postgraduate certificate in HE Administration, Leadership and Management, run by the Association of Higher Education Professionals. So congratulations for that. Taking on postgraduate study at the same time as working is a big undertaking, but hopefully has some rewarding outcomes, and sometimes outcomes you don't anticipate at the start. What would you say have been the main outcomes for you?
Thank you. It was hard work balancing work and study. And it's something I have done before, and I don't recommend anyone go into it without thinking hard about it, because it does involve giving up your spare time and your mental space for thinking about things when you're trying to balance the two. I came into management and have managed for 8 or 9 years now, without any formal training whatsoever. And I saw some research recently that the Chartered Management Institute, the CMI, found that 82% of managers start leadership positions without any formal training. So I think that's a lot of us, particularly in higher education. So most of what I've learned was by doing, observing, trying, making mistakes, trying, reflecting, trying again. And I have degrees in history and post-colonial studies, neither of which tell you anything practical or helpful about people management. So it was only after I'd learned so much of what I'd know through experience that I started the postgraduate certificate. And it drew together my academic and intellectual pursuits with my professional practice. And most importantly for me personally, is it introduced me to the value of reflective practice and broadened my networks professionally beyond admissions. Because admissions has a really fantastic professional community, but it's great sometimes to step away from that particular niche and look wider.
So what was it about reflective practice that you found so valuable?
I was very skeptical about reflective practice and its value. I thought, I'm reflective, I review things all the time. But it really did help me slow down my thinking and step back and reflect on my learning and think more concertedly about how I would shift my behaviors when I'm working with my team. And it also gave me a language to articulate things when I'm working with others around reviewing things and reflecting on things and maybe adjusting approaches and also navigating some of those tricky conversations.
And what else did you find valuable or enjoy about the course?
I also enjoyed massively the opportunity to network and communicate and study with others across the sector. And it, because it's distance learning, it gave me the opportunity to collaborate with colleagues working in Scotland and Wales and all over the UK, which I wouldn't have got to do if I had gone to something that was a taught, you know, in-person provision. So the fact that they've moved it used to be study days. It's stayed online since COVID. And I think that's really beneficial because it's really broadened the reach of the community that can take part in it. And it exposed me to the Association of Higher Education professional framework of practice. Again, very useful tools as a manager when you're trying to articulate things to your staff members and help them understand how they can develop their skills or what they need to focus on.
And from what I've read, a further outcome, which you haven't mentioned yet, appears to have been you writing a community of practice book to support the development of other colleagues working in higher education professional services. Can you say a bit more about what sparked that idea originally and how you've gone about creating the book?
Yes, I didn't set out to write a book. That was an unexpected outcome. There are scores of books for academics in higher education looking for support to develop their teaching and research skills. But I had to search a really long time to find anything for professional services, officers and managers in the UK. And there's just really limited resources and information out there that are reflective of our unique circumstances in higher education in the UK. So my aim was to bring together the information, advice, guidance that I felt was lacking when I needed it earlier in my career. And I wanted to, I suppose, foreground the experience of professional staff working in higher education and raise our voices. So I have interviewed 11 professionals across the sector to bring their learning and experience together and share their best practice in alignment with what we expect academic colleagues to do and are supported to do. So the book's called Surviving and Thriving in Higher Education Professional Services. And it has been accepted for publication subject to contract. So it should be out in spring 2025, which is very exciting.
And wrapping up our conversation today, Rachel, you've been working in higher education since 2011, and you've developed quite a portfolio of activity during that time. I mean, we've talked about your role, we've talked about the postgraduate course you've done, just talked about the book. Congratulations on that publication deal there. In terms of professional development support and thinking back on that, how do you think things have evolved for colleagues across that time? And how would you like to see things develop further, say, across the next 5 years?
I think the sector has come away in the last couple of years. COVID was a real leveler. It was an opportunity for colleagues to work so much more collaboratively without needing to travel between sites and things like that. And it has broken down some of the barriers, I think, between professional services and academics a little bit, because we were all struggling with different challenges and shared challenges. And it was a bit more evident, I suppose, some of the differences in how we were all operating, and it led to lots of streamlining and efficiencies of practice, which I think is really beneficial. But those traditional binaries, traditional inequalities between academics and professional services still continue, and we've got a long way to go when it comes to systematic differences like contracts. My current challenge and soapbox is contracts, because as someone on a professional services contract, I have to ask permission to enter into a contract to publish a book, and an academic wouldn't, because it's embedded in their contract that of course they will want to publish work in terms of their research. So there's some of that differences between roles that I think needs some more looking at and needs to change.
And what else would you like to see?
I would like to see the sector as a whole take more ownership of change and move away from being reactive and try and be a bit more united, because there are some things that draw the sector together, but the mission groups do still have quite different aims and goals in what they're trying to work towards. And ultimately, working at a low tariff, widening participation university, the challenges around admissions and recruitment are very different to those working in a Russell Group or in an Oxbridge College. We have different challenges, and they shouldn't be divisions. We need to find a solution that works for us more collaboratively. In terms of admissions specifically, our sector-wide commitment to fair and inclusive admissions, as enshrined in the Fair Admissions Code of Practice, is vulnerable in this economic climate, I think. When the financial squeezes come, sometimes our ethics and principles get challenged, and we are pushed to compromise on them more than we might prefer to. So I wish for my part, to ensure that we don't compromise all the work that's been done on improving access to higher education when there's still so much more to do, particularly in a climate where we're looking at finance and funding is always under discussion and does need proper review by the government. But also the government are pulling us through level three qualification changes, which will change access to university as well. So I just hope that the financial pressures and government change don't mean that we lose ground where we've made such progress as a sector, and that we can build the professionalism of higher education professionals as well, and enabling more sort of CPD and practitioner-led opportunities to develop, and recognising the value of that work. I'd like it to be a bit more recognised if we could be.
And how would you like to see those sort of opportunities develop, I guess, for colleagues in sort of responding to that changing environment that you're talking about there? Is it a case of more courses? Is it a case of more conversations, more books, maybe?
Definitely more conversations and more space for professional services colleagues to speak in those spaces. I think there's a tradition or a culture of letting the academics do the talking for the sector. And we've got a huge amount to offer as professionals and those working directly with students, and particularly those working in recruitment and admissions, because we're dealing with inquirers and applicants, school leavers, college leavers, care leavers, you know, refugees, all those kinds of groups of people that are not working with academics necessarily to the same degree. So it's really important to listen to that voice. And I think that, you know, when you look at Australia and America, the Higher Education Administration and Professional Services have a very elevated, respected position in the structures. They're on different trajectories to academics within the higher education sector in those two countries, but they have equitable levels of respect and opportunity. And I'd like to see that lots of those courtesies around professional development that are extended to academics are extended to professional services. An example being, if someone wants to study module, you know, usually a postgraduate certificate in higher education teaching and learning comes with a contract when you start working in HE as an academic. It would be nice to see opportunities for professional services colleagues, for example, to study. I have a team member at the moment doing an MA in education, leadership and management part-time, and I've already had a word with the course coordinator about the lack of representation of the tertiary sector in that debate, because we're at university and we want to get staff to study. So I'd like to see more opportunities, professional staff, and to not move across those boundaries, but that divide is less rigid and that we have more flexibility of opportunity for professional services staff to engage with the academic learning, the intellectual side, I suppose, of HE as well, rather than it staying like a separated arrangement.
Rachel, thanks so much for being my guest today and letting me shadow you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Job Shadowing HE. The podcast was written and presented by Susanna Marsden. Audio production and music by me, Rodri Marsden. More information about this podcast and previous episodes can be found at jobshadowinghe.podbean.com.